නමෝ තස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස නමෝ තස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස නමෝ තස භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස අපරුතා තේ සංගමත සද්වාර යේසෝතවන්තෝ පුමුංචන්තු සදහන්ති Okay, so while we were on the way for the Dhamma talk tonight, I asked people to give some suggestions for what I should give as a Dhamma talk. I had a number of suggestions, and I haven't managed to choose one, so I thought maybe you can choose the Dhamma talk for tonight. Does that sound like a good idea? Yeah? Ah, very good. This is Buddhism, very Buddhism 2.0 here. Okay, so I'm going to give you, how about I give you three options, and you can vote on them. All right? Okay, number one, no religion. Okay? No religion, inspired by John Lennon, of course. Number two, life skills for the end of days. Right? And number three, the evolution of consciousness. Okay? So there's three topics. Number one, who wants no religion? Okay, a few. Okay. Life skills for the end of days. Again, a few. Evolution of consciousness. Oh, I think that's the winner, is it? A few people with two hands up. Is that fair? Maybe they should be disqualified. So is that the winner? Right, we have the winner. Okay, very good. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about with this topic is how mind grows and changes, right? We call it evolution. And I'm going to talk about it in the context of the Buddhist teaching of the five aggregates, the Panchupadana Kandha. And I'm going to explain the five aggregates in a sense as being an evolutionary model or a way of describing the human or sentient beings and our mind and body in a way that you can see in terms of evolution. And hopefully we can use that to understand ourselves better. But also I think that this is a very useful model for understanding some aspects of spiritual development and particularly some of the things that can go wrong. But first of all, I need to sort of clarify some terms and things before we get too far. First thing to understand is the evolution. When we use the word evolution and the evolution of consciousness, it's not quite the same thing as evolution in biology. But basically it means the change and development of something. But I think there is one similarity with the evolution in biology is that in biology there's no kind of idea of progress in a sense. Things don't sort of get better, but on the whole things tend to get more diverse, right? That there's more, the biosphere gets more, has more capacity if you like, right? There's more, it's like branching out more different things. So I think it's the same thing with the evolution of consciousness. When we're talking about evolution in this sense, we don't mean that things just get better, okay? But what we mean is the mind has a greater capacity. Right? And, of course, what you choose to do with that capacity is up to you. Right? So, in the old days, if you're a caveman, you could pick up a stick and whomp and hurt somebody. These days you can press a button on a nuclear missile and kill a million people. That's evolution, okay? So it really depends on how you choose to use it, but your capacity is greater, okay? So I think that's one thing. Second thing that's different with the evolution of consciousness is that at a certain point, perhaps not at the point, but I think over time, we become aware of that process, right? Consciousness can become aware of itself, right? So we can, the evolution of consciousness itself, at a certain point, becomes self-aware. Yeah? And I don't know about you, but for me, that point pretty much is when I did my first meditation retreat. Right, and that's when you actually become aware of your own mind and can reflect on it, and you can actually see your mind growing and changing. Okay, and just another point of clarification, and the reason I'm mentioning these things is because when I was trying to understand these things myself, I kept on getting tripped up on the vocabulary. But one thing when we use the word consciousness in this sense is not the same as what we mean when we use the Buddhist word vijnana, which is usually translated as consciousness in Buddhism. Okay, so vijnana means just awareness itself. It's a very simple quality. And vijnana is part of the consciousness which is evolved, but it's not the whole thing. So the evolution of consciousness means much more kind of the evolution of and change of your mind as a whole, you know, your thoughts, memories, how you use your mind, your perceptions and so on, part of which is awareness, but many other things as well. So, as with so many things, I think the Buddha was perhaps the first person to talk about this kind of thing quite explicitly. We even find a term in the early Buddhist texts, which we can literally translate as the evolution of consciousness, which is cetto-vivatta. And cetto-vivatta, literally, evolution of consciousness. And so one of the fundamental things about Buddhism is that the mind is not static, okay? It's not given, right? This is one of the fundamental principles which the Buddha argued for constantly, was that mind, consciousness, awareness is not something which is eternal. It's not something which is just there. It's not a blank slate, right? The mind is conditioned, okay? Again and again and again. This is one of the most fundamental of the Buddha's teachings. And in saying this, he was, of course, directly opposing the Upanishadic teaching which came before the Buddha, where the mind or consciousness was something which was infinite and eternal, and our current experience of that was limited, but that the consciousness itself was always infinite and eternal. And the Buddha flat out denied that idea, and he said that consciousness is something which arises dependent on conditions. And because those conditions are always impermanent and limited, then the consciousness which arises from that itself is always impermanent and conditioned. So the evolution of consciousness, how the mind grows, changes and develops according to cause and conditions, okay, over time. So we'll briefly consider the five, we'll call the five khandhas, five aggregates, okay? Rupa, first one, is rupa, the physical world in general. Curiously enough, we don't really have an English word to refer to the physical world in general, do we? Kind of matter is too specific because rupa also includes energy, right? It's like tejo, which is matter, which is energy, not matter. Anyway, so the physical world in general, but specifically what rupa mainly refers to is your own body and how you perceive the physical world, right? It's not an objective physical world out there, but it's what you see, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, okay? Rupa vedana is feeling, okay? Sanya is perception. Sankhara is volitions, choices. And vijnana is awareness. We usually translate it as consciousness. But to avoid the confusion that I mentioned before, I'll try to remember to translate it as awareness. Okay, so rupa, form, the material realm, feelings, perception, choices or intentions, and awareness, the five aggregates, panchupadana khandha. Okay, so of course, each of us has all of these five aggregates, five khandhas. Not just human beings have them, all of the animals, other sentient beings have them as well. However, even though we all have them, they are still something which evolve or unfold, and we can see that unfolding happening in our own lives, personal development. We can also see it happening through society and through history. Like most of the frameworks which the Buddha offered, they move from something which is simpler, more basic, towards something which is more abstract and more refined, more subtle. Right? And if we look and if we understand this model of consciousness which the Buddha is offering here, actually it's very striking how similar that is to many of the models which are developed in modern psychology. Okay, so I'm thinking of things like, say, Maslow's hierarchy of needs and other things like that, which have a similar pattern, not necessarily identical and not always from the same perspective, but you can recognize the similarities of patterns. I'm not going to go into that now, but I'll just sort of mention that. Okay, so let's just have a quick look to sort of see what these five things are and how they relate to each other. Okay, so I said the first one is matter. So you see matter is the most kind of primary kind of substance in the world, the physical world. Matter, inanimate objects have matter, plants have matter, yeah, animals have matter, yeah. Humans have matter. But the matter as seen in Buddhism is both the matter which comprises our own body, so it's our own thing that keeps us going, but also that which we are aware of. And of course, matter is regarded primarily as analyzed in terms of the four elements, right? So the earth, water, fire, and air. So these are basically the three states of matter: solid, liquid, and gas, and energy, which is the transformative element. Okay. So, from a Buddhist point of view, consciousness is not an emergent property. Okay, now this is an idea which is very common in modern times, that we think that matter is primary and unconscious, but then when it gets organized in a certain way to make something we call a brain, somehow consciousness leaps up out of the top of it and we're self-aware. Okay, this is this emergent phenomena. From a Buddhist point of view, that's not the case. From a Buddhist point of view, it's probably better to think about consciousness as being somehow folded in or immanent in matter, or involved in matter in some way right from the beginning. The five khandhas are always there. But I don't want to go too much into that question, but just so you know that. Okay, so think about the very most simple kind of organisms, right? So like plankton or bacteria, or think about yourself. Just after you're conceived, you know, just a small little bundle of cells inside your mummy's womb. What's the first thing? One of the first things that happens with even the most simple kind of organism is that they will retract from some kind of painful sensation. Yeah, you poke them or bring it flame or heat, and they will move away. Yeah, and if there's some food or something, they'll move towards it. Yeah, this is the most primal aspect of awareness that's starting to develop, and this is what we call feeling. Okay, Vedana. Now it's important to understand that feeling, in this sense, okay, is just that purely simple primal response, like, dislike, don't care. Three kinds of feelings, right? Pleasure, painful, neutral feeling. It's not complicated emotions and, oh, I don't know, do I love him or do I not? And sometimes I do, but then I hate him at the same time and so on. That's all kind of happening at a much higher level of evolution, right? This is just a primal feeling which even very simple organisms and so on have. Even plants, do plants have feelings? They respond as if they do, don't they? They kind of retract away from painful sensations and towards pleasant, well, they'll turn towards the sun and so on. Is that feelings, or does that just look like they have feelings? I'm not sure. I'll leave that one for the experts. Anyway, feelings. So the realm of feelings actually is especially characteristic of the animal realm, isn't it, right? So most animals, basically, that's what they're driven by, right? They get food, get sex, get all those things, and then if they get anything painful, they run away. So they have very short attention spans, usually, yeah? So driven by feelings. And, of course, that's part of us, just as we have the mat, we have the physical part of ourselves, we also have that feeling part of ourselves, okay? Perception, okay? So when we move to perception, also we can see animals have perception. Like, for example, animals will recognize names, right? You call out the animal's name or they'll recognize a voice and so on. But they do it on a much more basic level, okay? So the development of perception as in a very sophisticated way is something which is very characteristic of human and especially human culture, okay? So how does perception work? What do we mean when we're talking about perception? Well, what we mean is something like this: the ability to organize the huge, infinite data that we're presented through our senses, right? All of this stuff that we're seeing, the ability to organize that into meaningful wholes. Meaningful holes. This is what perception does, right? When I see the people sitting here, I know that this is a person, and the floor is a floor, and that's another person, right? My mind is actually putting you all together. My eyes aren't doing that, right? My eyes don't see people. My eyes just see light, okay? So perception is what's putting all of those things together, right? And then it's a way that's meaningful and it's useful. So, you know, a good way of thinking about perception, again, if you think about in terms of evolution, think about what a caveman wants, right? So a caveman sitting in the cave at night time, they hear a rustle in the bushes outside, right? And so your perception comes in. Your perception is either this is a deer or it's a tiger, okay? Very important distinction, right? If it's a deer, you have dinner. If it's a tiger, you are dinner. Yeah. So this is why perception works, to recognize things very, very quickly, right? And it's amazing how fast it is and how effective, right? You can see, you're just a glimpse of somebody, right? Or catch a fragment of their voice and you'll recognize their voice. Yeah, your perception works incredibly fast. Yeah. It was a study done, I saw some time ago, they did a study where they got a bunch of women and they showed them pictures of men's faces, okay? So they just flashed these men's faces for like a second and went off. And the women had to say, is this man interested in a committed relationship or just in a one-night fling? All right? True story, right? So this is what they did. And so the men who had their faces photographed had to fill out this on the form. When you meet a woman, which are you interested in? And the women just saw the flash of the thing and they had to guess. And, of course, the women guessed it pretty well accurately. Yeah, yeah, just from that flash of that face. Right? So that's, again, you can see that selection and so on is driving this, right? This is how we've survived. The world that we're in is so complicated, right? We have to reduce things, right? We have to simplify things. So perception takes a big, 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 big issue and simplifies it, right? So that we can cope. And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to cope, right? Now you can see how this has worked and evolved through human culture. We actually use this deliberately in human culture to create entities like, say, tribes, nations, families, right? All of these things we actually create cohesion around them using symbols. We have a flag or something like that, a song and all of these things, a football team, right? A particular brand that we like, we put a logo on it. And we're creating these unities, okay, which of course has a certain function, a certain value, otherwise we wouldn't do it, but it also divides people, doesn't it, right? And this is one of the things that we're seeing in our world today, that say something like religion, which we would hope should be something that raises us up, right? It should be something that draws us to a higher level of ethics and to a more expansive love of humanity and towards a more consciousness, right? But it seems that all too often it does exactly the opposite. It's dragging us back into tribal allegiances, back into these kind of basic prejudices and so on. And that whole area, that realm of human culture is very associated with this idea of perception and sanya. Okay? So when we learn to recognize this and understand that, then we can see how these things are going. One of the things about sanya, right, a perception, is perception is always it's always linked to the past. Okay? We train our mind by seeing things again and again, like seeing language, right? Seeing people, seeing these things, and then we learn to recognize them again in the future, right? This is how we go, right? You think about Sesame Street, right? Which one of these is not like the other one? Yeah, you have an orange and a banana and a bicycle, yeah, and you say which one of these is not like the other one, yeah, and that's perception, right? You're training to put these things in one category and this thing in another category. So it's all about what's happened in the past. Yeah? So this is why when when we rely too much on this aspect of ourselves, right? That we tend to be, on the one hand, it gives us a continuity and it makes things feel safe, right? But at the other hand, it also means we can't adapt to change. Right? And this is why you see that there's a link, isn't there, between this kind of tribal adherence, this kind of nationalist adherence, this adherence to some kind of sense of identity. It always seems to come back into the past, right? Never seems to have a vision for the future. Right? This is that sanya perception. Okay, so the next one of the five khandhas is the sankhara, which is a volition or intention, and it's the sankhara which is the one that looks to the future. Okay, so the sanya perception is the one that recognizes what's happened in the past, interprets the present, makes sense of the present in terms of what's happened in the past. Sankhara is the one that builds the future. Okay, this is your volition, your intention, your choice. Okay, now this is something, if you think about, say, the development of an infant, right? So a child, you know, the early development of a child in the womb, then, you know, when they're still very young, then they have, like, the feeling, the Vedana. Right? And when they're born, they gradually, they learn language, they learn to distinguish mother from father, food from not food, safe from dangerous, and all of these basic things. So they're developing their perception. Later on, they develop language and so on, they develop to a more high degree. When they come to maybe 7 or 8, but even much more so through adolescence, then they start to develop their sankhara, right? And sankhara really only becomes to you know, strength in the time of adolescence, in the teenage years. So that's the ability to choose, to reflect, to think about things, to understand right and wrong. Okay? So in that realm of perception, of sanya, okay, right and wrong is simply what's codified of what's happened in the past. Right? So this is how we decide what's right and what's wrong, because what's right and what's wrong is what was considered right and wrong in the past. And that's what power perception works. Sankhara works by reflecting, okay, in the present. So it's much more flexible, but it's also much more hard work. So sankhara is another stage in evolution. We can see that through childhood development. We can also see that through the development of societies. Okay? And similar, not necessarily it's identical, but similar patterns, right? So we can see that in simpler societies, tribal societies, village-level societies, up to and including, I would say, probably Neolithic societies, that perception is the most important thing. You know, you can see the symbol-making, right? The oldest symbol-making humanity is now traced back to about 100,000 BC in South Africa, right? Using colours and simple shapes and so on. And so this is that realm of perception, creating culture, creating meaningful wholes. And then, for some reason, it seems mostly around 500 BC, what we call the Axial Age, and people started to use this sankhara more, to be able to think, to reflect. We see in Greece the emergence of the philosophers, we see in the various developments in the Mesopotamian region and so on, in China, the great classics, Confucius, Lao Tzu and so on, and in India, the great flowering of contemplative culture with the Upanishads, the Jaina and other religious movements, and as well, of course, in Buddhism. And the essence of that sankhara and that volition is the idea that an individual can make a choice, and when they make a choice, they need to accept the responsibility for that choice. All right? Yeah? And by making a choice, it means that you can break with the past. Right? So your perception, yeah, how you've been shaped by what's happened in the past, now this can change because you can choose to do something differently. You've been brought up to do something this way your whole life, and now you can say, I'm going to make the choice to do it a different way. But what's very important is you also have to be able to say, and I will accept the responsibility for that choice. Yeah? So this is something which comes to fulfillment. As I said, it becomes prominent in adolescent years, but really it becomes to fulfillment through our adult life. And as we grow older, we become decision makers, buy houses, enter marriages, do jobs and so on. We take decisions and we accept the responsibilities for those. And we're able to reflect on whether these decisions are right and wrong. And this is all within that realm of choice or sankhara. And finally, you have vijnana, is consciousness, okay, awareness itself. Now, in terms of both cultural and individual personal development, right, vijnana mostly doesn't happen. Right? I mean, in Western culture, basically stops short with sankhara, right? Basically stops short with the ability, with reason. Yeah? Greek philosophy regarded reason as the highest, right? And through science and so on, that's always been the highest thing, the empirical method, thought, and so on and so forth. Only in India, it seems, perhaps in China also, but I'm not sure, but mostly only in India did we see the emergence of vijnana, of awareness itself, as being a primary concern. And this is something that happened in the Upanishads about 200 years before the time of the Buddha. People start asking, what is the knowing? And these phrases you see, what is the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower? Yeah? And this is vijnana, yeah, the knower of all of those things. And perhaps the key to the Buddha's insight was to say that this vijnana, this knower, this too is impermanent, is conditioned. Also in our lives today, for most people, most people don't actually deliberately develop this awareness. We deliberately develop our sankhara, right? We go to school, we learn stuff, we get information, we learn how to make decisions and things. But to develop awareness itself, until very recently, that was something that only a very, very few contemplatives did. And one of the great changes in our world today, and I think one of the most amazingly positive developments in the world that exists today, is that meditation has become so common. And meditation is nothing else but the conscious and deliberate attempt to develop awareness, right? To know better, to be more awake. Right? To have more clarity of consciousness and awareness. And for the first time, I think it's just amazing. For the first time, all around the world, right? There are millions and millions of people meditating. Yeah? It was until quite recently, this was just a specialist activity that was done by a few, you know, religious elite in monasteries or mountaintops or something. And now there are millions of people all around the world, probably hundreds of millions. So this is a huge shift in our world. You know? For the first time, our global culture has actually embraced this idea of the evolution of awareness, the evolution of consciousness, that we can sit down, reflect on our own mind, and take it further, yeah? Make our mind bigger, make it broader. I think this is tremendously exciting, right? I think this is the most exciting and positive things about the world today, where this might lead us to. Right. Now, if we think about these five aggregates, why these particular things did the Buddha focus on and so on? Well, in my opinion, this group wasn't an innovation, or his teaching wasn't an innovation of the Buddha as such, although he obviously used it in his own way, but it's one which seems to have been widely known among the ascetics in the time of the Buddha. It's referred to sort of in passing and casually on many occasions, as if everybody assumed you know what you're talking about. And the reason why these things are selected, I think, is because these things are like five things that people tend to identify as themselves. Okay, so rupa, your body, right? That's what people tend to take as their self, don't they, right? You look in the mirror and you think, wow. Well, maybe you do. Actually, one of my favorite old blues songs, started out with the immortal lines that said, I wake up in the morning, I get out of bed, I go to the bathroom, I look in the mirror, oh man, I'm so ugly. Right, so we identify with our body as ourself, okay? But then, of course, that's not very satisfactory, is it? Because your body changes, right? It gets old and you know, all of these things. And so can that really be yourself? So then people often identify with their feeling as their self, right? Right? I am so sad. I am so happy. Right? What is that if not identifying with your feelings? Yeah. And then when people think about this, for example, you think about in terms of rebirth, right? People think, oh, I'm going to go to heaven and then I'm just going to experience happy feelings, right? Or I've done something bad, I'm going to go to hell and there I'm going to experience just bad feelings. So again, we identify with ourself as feelings, right? So also we identify with perception, right? Isn't it amazing how people get so hung up on this, right? I mean, this whole tragic event with these cartoons in France and the murders that happened as a result of that, it's just because of this ridiculous obsession with some kind of identity. I mean, it's just an image, right? It's just an image drawn on paper. Why are you getting so worked up about it? So this incredible over-identification that we have, you know, people get upset about because somebody likes a different computer program than the one that they use, right? Or because somebody wears a different pair of shoes than the one they use, right? And this is this kind of tribal identification. We identify with that. There's this perception, who we are, and so on. And then the sankhara is also what we identify as ourselves, right? Because we identify with our choices, right? And our thoughts. I am the decider, right? I am the decider. I remember George W. Bush said that one time. I am the decider. I think he was trying to convince himself of that. Right? But that's what we believe, don't we? We believe I'm in control of my life, right? I'm the one who makes the choice. Yeah? And this is so prominent in our society, especially our Western society these days, right? We want to be the ones to choose. We want to be the ones to vote. We want to be able to be the ones to say, hey, we're going to choose the Dhamma talk for tonight, right? I'm the decider. And we don't like it if we don't get our own way. Yeah. So again, we identify. And of course, ultimately, we identify with vijnana, with awareness itself. And this is something which is almost inevitably happens in a meditative or contemplative culture when people start to investigate vijnana, when they start to reflect on it, when they start to see it, when they start to immerse into that infinite ocean of radiant consciousness which you experience in meditation, then they're like, this is me, finally, I've come home. That's what it feels like. You go into deep meditation, it's just like coming home. It's just like you're, for the first time, I see who I truly am, is what this is. And that's why that idea is so seductive and so powerful. That's why it took the Buddha to come along and say, even that is conditioned. Even that you can let go of. Even that is still suffering. So with these five aggregates, when the Buddha talked about the five aggregates, he usually didn't call them five aggregates as such. He actually usually called them Panchupadana Kanda, the five grasping aggregates. Okay? Panchupadana Kanda. Five grasping aggregates. Yeah? So that is very useful because that's giving us a metaphor that explains why there's five of them, right? Because they grasp like your hand, yeah? And if you get too attached to them, that's why they're the Panchupadana. Pancha is five in Pali, but that's why they're pancha, because they'll punch you in the head if you don't be careful, okay? You think that I'm being silly, no? But if you know your etymology, you know the English word punch is actually from the same root as word five, ultimately from the idea of the hand, okay? So I'm not as silly as all that, right? But this is where it comes from, the idea of the hand, right? Now the hand, interestingly enough, is divided into 4 plus 1, okay? Yeah? This is also something that's very interesting to understand about early Buddhism. Not many people sort of get this. But 5 plus 1, right? So what's the one, right? What's the thumb? Okay? So if you think about this, normally you'd think the thumb must be rupa, okay? Because all the others are mental, right? So feeling, perception, choices, and consciousness. These are all mind stuff, right? And rupa is body stuff. So the one must be the rupa, and the five must be these, right? Actually, that's not what the Buddha said at all. He said the one which is separate is vijnana, awareness. Okay, that's how he divided it up. These four khandhas stand against vijnana, stand against awareness. Yeah? So from a Buddhist point of view, the most fundamental distinction we make is not mind and matter, okay, or mind and body. The most fundamental distinction we make is between awareness, right, and everything else. The awareness of everything else. Yeah? It's very important to understand early Buddhism. This whole division of mind and matter is never regarded as fundamental. Yeah? Now, so this is giving you some idea of the five khandhas in terms of the evolution of consciousness. Now, this gives us a number of things which is actually quite useful. One thing which is useful about it is that it reminds us that if we want to develop spiritually, we should pay attention to and ensure that each aspect of these things is developed. This is important and very, very useful. So the physical aspect, right? So to make sure we look after our bodies, make sure that all of that is done properly. And if we look in the Buddha's teachings, in the suttas and the Vinaya, we find he talks about that a lot, right? Having an appropriate dwelling place, having an appropriate place to live, eating food in the right amount, sleeping the right amount. All of these things is about looking after yourself physically as a basis for your spiritual practice. But also the feeling is also important. And this is something, again, the Buddha emphasized. Sukhupanisa samadhi. If you want to develop those deep states of consciousness, you need to be happy, right? So happiness is looking after your feelings, right? And perception, okay? This is something that we develop in our spiritual practice. Now, through a spiritual or religious practice, we use our perceptions, our religious symbols and iconography, okay? We have Buddha images. We have the name Buddhism, the idea of a Buddhist community. We have rituals and so on. We have Buddhist symbols, the Dhamma wheel and things like that. And this is kind of part of our sense of religious identity, right? Now, there's nothing wrong with religious identity as such. It's just like anything else, okay? As long as we don't take it too seriously, right? It's just a set of conventions, that's all, right? So, what that does, remember, what perception does is it creates meaningful holes. Okay, so it helps us to put things together. So, for example, how do we feel like a community? Okay, this is something that's very important. How do we feel like a community? Right, through these symbols, right, or through this identification with these symbols. I'll come back to that in a minute. So, and then also sankhara is intention, volition, and so on. So, this is something also needs to be exercised in Buddhism, right? Through studying, through reflecting, through talking, through being able to articulate your views and ideas to challenge other people and to have a meaningful discussion about that. This is all sankhara, right? And vijnana, of course, through the development of meditation. Now, so each of these things is part of our spiritual practice, and each thing needs to be developed in balance. And it's also quite interesting because you notice that immediately, as soon as you see that framework, you notice that there can be tendencies to develop these things in a way that's out of balance. Okay, and I'll just mention a few of those cases here, which probably are very well known to most people here. So, for example, if we look in traditional Buddhist societies, and this is something that we hear people telling us again and again and again, in traditional Buddhist societies, it's just all about the rituals, right? Just a chanting and the bowing, you chant a bunch of words, nobody knows what the words mean, right? If you have your religious scriptures, your Tipitaka, it's in a cabinet on the shrine and the key has been locked and good luck trying to find where the key is, right? And all of these things just become symbols, okay? And it's just all about those things. And so it kind of gets stuck there. And in those kind of societies, often you don't find an ability to inquire, to challenge, to critically discuss the Dhamma and to talk about it. Those things don't happen. It's considered there's something wrong with you if you ask questions. Okay? It's just not done. Right? So it's sort of stuck on sannya, on perception, and doesn't actually develop the sankhara. Right? And so your piousness, your spiritual value is determined by the amount to which you're stuck in the past. Remember that sannya and perception is inherently past-based. So with this if your spiritual development is stuck there, then your ultimate value is to preserve your Buddhist culture, your Buddhist tradition, your Buddhist heritage, and to keep that unaltered. And if you challenge that or want to change that, there's something inherently wrong with you. Okay? Yeah. So this is a problem that we see in a lot of the Buddhist cultures, and why a lot of the Buddhist cultures find it very hard to grapple with modernity. Because modernity, of course, is all about sankhara. It's all about questioning. It's all about making up your own mind. It's all about being an individual. Now, of course, we can have that other problem if we've come, especially people like myself, who've come outside of Buddhism from a non-traditional background, then we tend to approach it from the idea of sankhara, right? So we read books, we talk about it with friends, we discuss it on the internet, we do all of these kinds of things, and we often end up with quite an intellectual, individualized take on Buddhism, right? Which doesn't have the balance and the grounding that comes from actually manifesting Buddhism within a community, within a lived community. And so often that kind of Buddhism can be very unbalanced. You can have people who maybe have a good knowledge of suttas or dhamma or stuff like that, but then they are very kind of angry and opinionated and so on and so forth. And you don't have that sense of what it means to actually participate in the life of Buddhism, right, as you do within the Buddhist community. So in that case, you know, it is really useful for people to actually spend time learning those things, learning the rituals, learning to bow, learning to be part of a community which kind of feels the Dhamma, has a sense of the Dhamma, right? As well as being able to think and reflect about it. So neither one of these things are perfect or complete in themselves. They're all part of how our spiritual practice should be developed. You know, many times I see people who come from traditional Buddhist backgrounds, and I see people who are like lawyers or engineers and doctors, very highly educated, extremely intelligent, able to have very intellectual discussions on any number of topics. But then when they come to talk about Buddhism, their mind is still in primary school, right? When they last went to Dhamma class and so on, and they will talk about Jataka stories and past lives of the Buddha as if these were kind of historical facts. And to get your head around the idea of actually looking at the Dhamma in a reflective and critical and intelligent way, the same way that we deal with anything else. Right? This is something which it's challenging. It takes time. It takes work to actually get that. Right? And then, but the other kind of imbalance we get is the imbalance with meditation, with vijnana, developing awareness. Right? And very often in Buddhism we hear people say things like, oh, you think too much. Don't think, it's bad for you, right? And I don't know whether you've encountered this yourself, but I've seen this many times. And people have this kind of attitude that somehow thinking is wrong, and you don't have to think, just make your mind quiet, and then that's good enough, right? Well, it's not quite that simple. Often what happens is that people are too, I think, often too lazy to learn to study the Dhamma, to reflect it, to think about it properly. It's easy to be told you don't have to do that. You just sit and meditate and that's good enough, right? But what it means is that you're always reliant on what the teacher is feeding you. It becomes the guru cult. Yeah? You're kind of skipping from sanya, from perception, all the way to vijnana, while leaving out the sankhara side of things. And so what I often find in Buddhism is that people have been meditators for many years, but the idea that they are mature adults who can make their own decisions, right, is something that's foreign to them. The idea that you might disagree with something that your teacher says, okay, and be able to discuss that in a meaningful way with your teacher, and to be able to say, well, it's okay to have different opinions, right, and that we can talk about that in a reasonable manner, it just can't happen, right? The idea that you might even suggest that is considered to be heretical, right? And you can see, this isn't just an abstract thing. You can see the emotional response that comes up in some people when you suggest, well, actually, maybe your teacher is wrong. you can't do that, right? And so this is, to me, is one of the wonderful things living at Bodhinyana Monastery. We're very happy to tell Ajahn Brahm he's wrong. And we do a lot, right? And it's very much the opposite of that whole kind of guru thing, you know. Of course you respect your teacher. It's not about not respecting your teacher. But part of respecting your teacher in a mature way is the ability to inquire, to disagree, to question, to doubt, right? You know, if you look in the suttas, in the early Buddha's text, you see people did this to the Buddha all the time, right? Almost every second sutta is somebody coming up and disagreeing with the Buddha. Well, there's a bit of an exaggeration, not every second sutta, but anyway, it happens a lot. People come up and they argue with him and disagree with him. And he never says to him, you shouldn't argue with me. He never says you shouldn't disagree. He always listens to what they say and will respond. He'll either say, yes, this is true, or say, no, that's wrong, and give reasons and have discussion about it. But there's never this idea that somehow it's intrinsically wrong to disagree with your teacher. Right? You even have an example, like just one example out of many in the Meghya Sutta, where the Buddha's attendant Meghya says, I want to go to this grove to meditate. Please give me leave. And the Buddha says, well, it's just you and I here, so please stay with me until somebody else comes. And Meghya says, but I really want to go off to this forest to meditate. And the Buddha says, well, I think it'd be a good idea if you waited here. And then a third time he says, but I really want to go. And the Buddha says, well, okay, if you really want to go, then please go. Right? Now, get your head around that, right? He's the student of the Buddha. Living with the Buddha alone, okay, imagine if you had that opportunity to spend some time just hanging out with the Buddha, right? And then you make a suggestion to him, I want to go and meditate, and he says, I don't think that's a good idea, right? And you insist on doing it anyway, right? So, yeah. But, you know, the Buddha never punished him, he never criticized him, he never said, you have to do what I say, right? He said, well, you want to go and meditate, so you go. And so he went and meditated and had an awful meditation, came back to the Buddha, and Buddha's like, I told you so. Oh, the Buddha wasn't like that. If that was me, that's what I would have done, right? No, actually, if it was me, I probably would have sat there thinking, I told you so, I told you so. And anyway, I'm sure the Buddha didn't think that, but anyway, he gave him a very nice teaching. So, but the idea is that this is sankhara, questioning, right? The ability to think for yourself, to make your own decisions. You're an adult. We're not children, okay? We are not children, and we can't live a spiritual life that expects us to behave like children, okay? So we have to learn to develop our sankhara ability to reflect, to make up our own minds, and we can't skip that in our spiritual development, okay? It needs to be part of what we're doing, right? And when that's done as part of what we're doing, then the meditation will, of course, be successful and will happen in a much more organic way. And that's the vijnana, is the final thing, the awareness itself. So, briefly, this is this idea that how the evolution of consciousness or the structure of consciousness from the coarse aspects to the more refined aspects through the five khandhas. And by understanding these, reflecting them, we can see how they're operating inside ourselves. We can understand how they're operating in development of an individual through the growth and development of societies as a whole. It can help us sometimes to diagnose problems that we see around us. It helps us to know what areas we need to work on. It helps us to identify sometimes what might be lacking in our own practice, how we need to integrate or balance our own practice better. And it helps us to avoid the problem psychologists call spiritual bypassing, which is spiritual bypassing is essentially where you kind of leap over things that you need to be developing. So where people, classic example would be where people, you go to work and you have an argument with somebody at work and then you come home and you say, oh, I'm going to meditate. And so you meditate and you forget about everything and make your mind peaceful and think, therefore, I've kind of solved the problem, right? This is called spiritual bypassing, right? In fact, that problem needs to be addressed with right speech, not with right meditation, right? Right speech is an aspect of your sankhara khanda, right? To be able to talk to somebody and work through the problems in a good way. And don't just think because you can meditate and forget about it that you've somehow forgotten the problem. That's spiritual bypassing. So the main point of this is that each of these aspects of our mind and our consciousness is part of who we are, okay? We all have these things. And we all have to use these positively and constructively in our spiritual practice. Okay? How we do that, of course, is different for everybody. Right? We're all different. We're all coming from different places, and we can't make too many generalizations about that. So we have to find out for ourselves how to do that. But at least we know that there are these different areas of practice that we can look at. So this is my talk for this evening on the evolution of consciousness. And I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if there are any comments or questions. Oh, I think we're going to have the... sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You can say unsadhu if you like. Asadhu, no good. one of the suttas where it says that every one of the suttas it says the monks rejoiced at the end of it, but there's one where it says that the monks didn't like what the Buddha said at all. They didn't like it. So that's okay too. Okay, right, here we go. Robert from Germany, how's it going, Robert? The experience of Nibbana is often said to involve the ceasing of all khandhas, including consciousness. How can one reflect on this experience if there's no consciousness? And that is the fifth khanda. Okay, so this is an issue which is discussed sometimes in Buddhism. I've talked about this at some length on my blog, if you want to have a look at the discussion there. Somewhat lengthy discussion. One of the problems here is that the word Nibbana is used in a number of different ways and has a number of different nuances. And so we have to sort of see how it means in a particular context. Okay? Now, one common meaning of the word Nibbana is to mean the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay? Lobha, dosa, moha. So if those three things have ended, then that's said to be Nibbana. Now, of course, that applies to the waking or the lived experience of an enlightened being, an arahant, okay, that they have ended greed, hatred, and delusion. But in that case, everything else about them is pretty much ordinary. Okay, they still have the five khandhas, right? They still, mind still works the same. They still have feelings, perceptions, thoughts, intentions, awareness. Everything goes pretty much the same. The only thing is, there's no greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, so that's something, of course, which you can and do have a direct and very clear awareness of. Okay. Now, the other aspect of Nibbana is what they sometimes call parinibbana, but that's a somewhat confusing terminology, sometimes called anupadisesa Nibbana, and this is what happens when an arahant, when a fully enlightened person, dies. And when they die, then not only the body finishes and breaks up, but also the other five khandhas finish and break up as well, feeling, perception, intention, and vijnana. All of them come to an end. And so when that happens, of course, we can't meaningfully talk about experience anymore. And this is something which, in a sense, is very mysterious, right? So what does it actually mean to say that parinibbana means the ending of the five khandhas or the five aggregates? Well, it means a number of things. One thing it means is that, well, certainly we know that nobody's ever asked for their money back, okay? So nobody's actually complained, you know, I've entered parinibbana and I didn't like it, okay? So that's good. But the main point about it is that suffering has come to an end. Okay, so this is the main thing that the Buddha was pointing to with that. That's probably enough for that question. Okay, other questions, comments? Jokes? Yeah. Mike is coming.
Thank you for your talk tonight and beautiful meditation, as always.
Thank you.
You talked about the problem. You have a problem at work and then you come home and you meditate and you're skipping the problem.
Right.
I feel that my meditation often brings awareness on the problem and I solve things through meditation, not through just blanking out.
Hmm.
That's just what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not certainly not meaning to imply that meditation is always an inappropriate response or doesn't work. Of course, I'm just saying that sometimes it can be used in that way to sort of escape the problem, so that you can, you know, and the reason how you see the difference is very simple, right? What happens when you go back to work the next day? And if you go back to the work the next day and you repeat the same mistakes that you made and get the same stress and then come back, then obviously it's not really working properly. But if you come back the next day and you approach the problem with more compassion, with more wisdom, and then you move towards improving it, then the meditation is working properly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just behind you.
Listening to your talk, I could understand what emerged as the structure of consciousness.
Mm.
I'm just wondering what you were referring to when you were talking to the evolution, when you referred to the evolution of consciousness. Mm. What aspect of your talk was actually involved with the process of evolution?
Well, evolution in the sense of like a sort of progressive change, like a directional change, yeah? So that within a particular an individual, so you evolve or change or develop through your life, and similarly through society. I think societies and cultures also evolve and change, although that's probably less easy to define. But yeah, that's the main thing. It's not evolution necessarily in the sense of natural selection, which is I'm not sure how relevant that principle is. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah? Okay. Any more questions? Okay, so I think it's getting a little bit late, so we should maybe be finishing up. So we'll finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem. And hopefully we'll see you all here on Sunday afternoon, 12:30 to 6:30. Oh, just by the way, just in case anyone's wondering, last time we did the early Buddhism course, we did like a whole day course, and this one we're doing at 12:30. The reason for that is because it was kind of a bit awkward because of the other events that are happening in the Buddhist society. So that was mainly so we could avoid clashing with the sort of normal program on the weekend. So we put the course on the Sunday afternoon. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.